Half an hour later, the two of them were walking between the rusty steel rails as they curved gently past the municipal golf course. Except they had drifted up a little higher above the short-time world after their meeting with the wino, perhaps because he had been a little high himself, and walking was not exactly what they were doing. There was little or no effort involved, for one thing, and although their feet were moving, to Ralph it felt more like gliding than walking. Nor was he entirely sure they were visible to the short-time world. Squirrels hopped unconcernedly about their feet, busy gathering supplies for the winter ahead. And once he saw Lois duck sharply as a wren almost parted her hair. The bird veered to the left and upward, as if realizing only at the last moment that there was a human in its flight pattern. The golfers didn't pay them any mind either. Ralph's opinion of golfers was that they were self-absorbed to the point of obsession, but he thought this lack of interest extreme, even so. If he had seen a couple of neatly dressed adults strolling along a defunct GS and WM spur line in the middle of the day, he thought he might have taken a brief time out to try and guess what they were up to and where they might be going. "I think I'd be especially curious about why the lady kept on muttering, 'Stay where you are, you darned old thing,' and hitching at her skirt," Ralph thought and grinned. But the golfers didn't even spare them a glance. Although a foursome, bound for the ninth hole, passed close enough so that Ralph could hear them worrying over a developing softness in the bond market. The idea that he and Lois had become invisible again, or at least very dim, began to seem more and more plausible to Ralph. Plausible and worrisome. "Time goes faster when you're high," old Dor had said. The trail became fresher as they went west, and Ralph liked the drips and splashes which made it up less and less. Where the goop had fallen on the steel rails, it had eaten away the rust like corrosive acid. The weeds it had fallen on were black and dead. Even the hardiest of them had died. As Ralph and Lois passed Derry Muni's third green and entered a tangle of scrawny trees and undergrowth, Lois tugged at his sleeve. She pointed ahead. Large splotches of Atropos's spore gleamed like sick paint on the trunks of the trees now pressing in close to the tracks, and there were pools of it in some of the sunken dips between the old rails, places where cross ties had once been, Ralph supposed. "We're getting close to where he lives, Ralph." "Yes. If he comes back and finds us in his place, what will we do?" Ralph shrugged. He didn't know and wasn't sure he cared. Let the forces that were moving them around like pawns on a chessboard, the ones Mr. C and Mr. L had called the higher purpose, worry about that. If Atropos showed up, Ralph would try to yank out the little bald bugger's tongue and strangle him with it. And if that upset somebody's apple cart, too goddamn bad. He couldn't take responsibility for grand plans and long-time business. His job now was to watch out for Lois, who was at risk, and try to stop the carnage that was going to occur not far from here in just a few hours. And who knew? He might even find a little extra time along the way, which he could use to try and protect his own partially rejuvenated hide. This was the stuff he had to do, and if the nasty little fuck got in Ralph's way, one of them was going down. If that didn't fit in with the big boy's plans, tough titty. Lois was picking most of this up from his aura. He could read that in her own when she touched his arm and he turned to look at her. "What does that mean, Ralph? That you'll try to kill him if he gets in our way?" He considered this, then nodded. "Yeah, that's exactly what it means." She thought about it, then nodded. "Ralph," he looked at her, eyebrows raised, "if it needs to be done, I'll help you do it." He was absurdly touched by this, and at pains to hide the rest of his thinking from her, that the only reason she was still with him at all was so that he could keep a protective eye on her. That thought led him back toward her earrings, but he pushed the image of them away, not wanting her to see or even suspect them in his aura. Lois's thoughts, meanwhile, had gone on in a different, marginally safer direction. "Even if we get in and out without meeting him, he'll know someone was there, won't he? He'll probably know who it was, too." Ralph couldn't deny it, but didn't see that it mattered much. Their options had been narrowed to just this one, at least temporarily. They would take it a step at a time and just keep hoping that when the sun came up tomorrow morning, they would be around to see it. Although, given a choice, I'd probably opt to sleep in, Ralph thought, and a small wistful grin touched the corners of his mouth. God, it feels like years since I slept in. His mind flashed from there to Carolyn's favorite saying, the one about how it was a long walk back to Eden. It seemed to him right now that Eden might simply be sleeping until noon, or maybe a little past. He took Lois's hand and they started forward along Atropos's trail again. 40 feet east of the cyclone fence marking the edge of the airport, the rusty tracks petered out. Atropos's trail pushed on, however, although not for long. Ralph was quite sure he could see the spot where it ended, and the image of the two of them roped to the spokes of a big wheel recurred. If he was right, Atropos's den was only a stone's throw from where Ed had run into the fat man with the barrels of fertilizer in the back of his pickup truck. The wind gusted, bringing them a sick, rotten smell from close by. And from a little farther away, the voice of Fay Chapin, haranguing someone on his favorite subject. What I always say, Mahjong is like chess. Chess is like life, so if you can play either of those games... The wind dropped again. Ralph could still hear Fay's voice if he strained his ears, but he had lost the individual words. That was all right, though. He had heard the lecture often enough to know pretty much how it went. Ralph, that stink is awful. It's him, isn't it? He nodded, but didn't think Lois saw him. She held his hand tightly in hers, looking straight ahead with wide eyes. The splotchy track which had begun at the doors of the Civic Center ended at the base of a drunkenly leaning dead oak tree 200 feet away. The cause of both the tree's death and its final leaning position was clear. One side of the venerable relic had been peeled like a banana by a glancing stroke of lightning. The cracks and crenellations and bulges of its gray bark seemed to make the shapes of half-buried, silently screaming faces, and the tree spread its nude branches against the sky like grim ideograms, ones which bore, at least in Ralph's imagination, an uncomfortable resemblance to the Japanese ideograms, which meant kamikaze. The bolt which had killed the tree hadn't succeeded in knocking it over, but it had certainly done its best. The part of its extensive root system, which faced the airport, had been yanked right out of the ground. These roots had extended beneath the chain-link fence and pulled a section of it upward and outward in a bell shape that made Ralph think, for the first time in years, of a childhood acquaintance named Charles Engstrom. "Don't you play with Chucky," Ralph's mother used to tell him. "He's a dirty boy." Ralph didn't know if Chucky was a dirty boy or not, but he was fruit crackers, no question about that. Chucky Engstrom liked to hide behind the tree in his front yard with a long tree branch, which he called his peaky wand. When a woman in a full skirt passed, Chucky would tiptoe after her, extending the peaky wand under the hem and then lifting. Quite often he got to check out the color of the woman's underwear. The color of ladies' underwear held great fascination for Chucky, before she realized what was going on and chased the wildly cackling lad back to his house, threatening to tell his mother. The airport fence, pulled out and up by the old oak's roots, reminded Ralph of the way the skirts of Chucky's victims had looked when he started to raise them with a peaky wand. "Ralph," he looked at her, "who's Piggy Juan? And why are you thinking about him now?" Ralph burst out laughing. "Did you see that in my aura?" "I guess so. I don't really know anymore. Who is he?" "Tell you another time. Come on." He took a hand, and they walked slowly toward the oak tree where Atropos's trail ended, into the thickening odor of wild decay that was his scent. They stood at the base of the oak, looking down. Lois was gnawing obsessively on her lower lip. Do we have to go down there, Ralph? Do we really?
Yes.
But why? What are we supposed to do? Take something he stole? Kill him? What?
Other than retrieve Joe's comb and Lois's earrings, he didn't know. But he felt certain he would know, that they both would when the time came.
I think for now we better just keep moving, Lois. The lightning had acted like a strong hand, shoving the tree violently toward the east and opening a large hole at the bottom on its western side. To a man or woman with short-time vision, that hole would undoubtedly look dark and maybe a little scary, with its crumbly sides and barely glimpsed roots squirming in the deep shadows like snakes. But otherwise, not very unusual. A kid with a good imagination might see more, Ralph thought. That dark space at the bottom of the tree might make him think of pirate treasure, outlaw hideouts, trawl holes. But Ralph didn't think even an imaginative short-time kid would have been able to see the dim red glow filtering up from beneath the tree, or realize that those squirming roots were actually rough rungs leading down to some unknown and undoubtedly unpleasant place. No, even an imaginative kid wouldn't see those things. But he or she might sense them. Right. And after doing so, one with any brains would turn and run as if all the demons of hell were in hot pursuit. As would he and Lois, if they had any sense at all. Except for Lois's earrings, except for Joe Wise's comb, except for his own lost place in the purpose, and of course, except for Helen, and possibly Nat, and the 2,000 other people who were going to be at the Civic Center tonight. Lois was right. They were supposed to do something, and if they backed out now, it was a something that would remain forever done, bun, undone. And those are the ropes, he thought. The ropes, the powers that be used to tie us poor, muddled, short-time creatures to their wheel. He now visualized Clotho and Lachesis through a bright lens of hate, and he thought that if the two of them had been here right now, they would have exchanged one of their uneasy looks and then taken a quick step or two away. And they would be right to do that, he thought. Very right. Ralph, what's wrong? Why are you so angry?
He raised her hand to his lips and kissed it.
It's nothing. Come on. Let's go before we lose our nerve.
She looked at him a moment longer, then nodded. And when Ralph sat down and poked his legs into the gaping, root-lined mouth at the foot of the tree, she was right beside him. Ralph slid beneath the tree on his back, holding his free hand over his face to keep dirt from crumbling into his open eyes. He tried not to flinch as root knuckles caressed the side of his neck and prodded the small of his back. The smell under the tree was a revolting monkey house aroma that made his gorge rise. He was able to go on kidding himself that he would get used to it, until he was all the way into the hole under the oak, and then the kidding stopped. He raised himself on one elbow, feeling smaller roots digging at his scalp and dangling flaps of bark tickling his cheeks, and ejected as much of his breakfast as still remained in the holding tank. He could hear Lois doing the same thing on his left. A terrible woozy faintness went rolling through his head like a breaking wave. The stench was so thick he was almost eating it, and he could see the red stuff they had followed to this nightmare place under the tree all over his hands and arms. Just looking at this stuff had been bad. Now he found himself taking a bath in it, for God's sake. Something groped for his hand, and he almost gave in to panic before realizing it was Lois. He laced his fingers through hers.
"Ralph, come up a little bit. It's better. You can breathe."
He understood what she meant at once, and had to restrain himself, haul himself down at the last moment. If he hadn't, he would have shot up the ladder of perception like a rocket under full thrust. The world wavered, and suddenly there seemed to be a little more light in this stinking hole. And a little more room, too. The smell didn't go away, but it became bearable. Now it was like being in a small closed tent full of people with dirty feet and sweaty armpits. Not nice, but something you could live with, at least for a while. Ralph suddenly imagined the face of a pocket watch, complete with hands that were moving too fast. It was better without the stench trying to pour down his throat and gag him, but this was still a dangerous place to be. Suppose they came out of here tomorrow morning, with nothing left of the Civic Center but a smoking hole on Main Street. And it could happen. Keeping track of time down here, short time, long time, or all time, was impossible. He glanced at his watch, but it was meaningless. He should have set it earlier, but he had forgotten.
Let it go, Ralph. You can't do anything about it, so let it go.
He tried, and as he did, it occurred to him that old Dorr had been 100% correct on the day Ed had crashed into Mr. Westside Gardner's pickup truck. It was better not to mess into long-time business. And yet here they were, the world's oldest Peter Pan and the world's oldest Wendy, sliding under a magic tree into some slimy underworld neither one of them wanted to see. Lois was looking at him, her pale face lit with that sick red glow, her expressive eyes full of fright. He saw dark threads on her chin and realized it was blood. She had quit just nibbling at her lower lip and had begun taking bites out of it.
Ralph, are you all right?
I get to crawl under an old oak tree with a pretty girl and you even have to ask? I'm fine, Lois, but I think we better hurry.
All right.
He felt around below him and placed his foot on a gnarled root knuckle. It took his weight, and he slid down the stony slope, squeezing beneath another root and holding Lois around the waist. Her skirt skidded up to her thighs, and Ralph thought again, briefly, about Chucky Engstrom and his peaky wand. He was both amused and exasperated to see Lois was trying to pull the skirt back down.
I know that a lady tries to keep her skirt down whenever possible, but I think the rule goes by the boards when you're sliding down troll staircases under old oak trees. Okay?
She gave him an embarrassed, frightened little smile. If I had known what we were going to be doing, I would have worn slacks. I thought we were just going to the hospital.
If I'd known what we were going to be doing, Ralph thought, I would have cashed in my bonds, developing softness in the market or not, and had us on a plane to Rio, my dear.
He felt around with his other foot, very aware that if he fell, he was probably going to end up in a place far beyond the reach of Derry Rescue. Just above his eyes, a reddish worm poked out of the earth, dribbling little crumbles of dirt down on Ralph's forehead. For what seemed like an eternity, he felt nothing, and then his foot found smooth wood. Not a root this time, but something like a real step. He slid down, still holding Lois around the waist, and waited to see if the thing he was standing on would hold or snap under their combined weight. It held, and it was wide enough for both of them. Ralph looked down and saw that it was the top step of a narrow staircase which curved down into the red-tinged dark. It had been built for, and perhaps by, a creature that was a lot shorter than they were, making it necessary for them to hunch, but it was still better than the nightmare of the last few moments. Ralph looked at the ragged wedge of daylight above them, his eyes gazing out of his dirt and sweat-streaked face with an expression of dumb longing. Daylight had never looked so sweet or so distant. He turned back to Lois and nodded to her. She squeezed his hand and nodded back. Bending over, cringing each time a dangling root touched their necks or backs, they started down the staircase. The descent seemed endless. The red light grew brighter. The stench of Atropos grew thicker. And Ralph was aware that they were both going up as they went down. It was either that or be flattened by the smell. He continued telling himself that they were doing what they had to do, and that there must be a timekeeper on an operation this big. Someone who would give them a poke if and when the schedule got too tight for comfort. But he kept worrying just the same, because there might not be a timekeeper, or an ump, or a team of refs in zebra-striped shirts.
All bets are off, Clotho had said.
Just as Ralph was starting to wonder if the stairs went all the way down into hell itself, they ended. A short, stone-lined corridor, no more than 40 inches high and 20 feet long, led to an arched doorway. Beyond it, that red glow pulsed and flared like the reflected glow of an open oven. "Come on, Lois, but be ready for anything. Be ready for him." She nodded, hitched at her wayward slip again, then walked beside him up the narrow passage. Ralph kicked something that wasn't a stone and bent over to pick it up. It was a red plastic cylinder, wider at one end than at the other. After a moment, he realized what it was. A jump rope handle. 3-6-9, hun. The goose drank wine.
"Don't butt into what doesn't concern you, short time," Atropos had said.
But he had butted in, and not just because of what the little bald doctors called Ka, either. He had gotten involved because what Atropos was up to was his concern. Whatever the little creep might think to the contrary, Derry was his town, Lois Chass was his friend, and Ralph found within himself a sincere desire to make Doc Number 3 sorry he'd ever seen Lois's diamond earrings. He flipped the jump rope handle away and started walking again. A moment later, he and Lois passed under the arch and simply stood there, staring into Atropos's underground apartment. With their wide eyes and linked hands, they looked more like children in a fairy tale than ever. Not Peter Pan and Wendy now, but Hansel and Gretel, coming upon the witch's candy house after days spent wandering in the trackless forest.
"Oh, Ralph! Oh, my God, Ralph! Do you see?"
"Shh, Lois, shh." Directly ahead of them was a small, mean chamber, which seemed to be a combination kitchen and bedroom. The room was simultaneously sordid and creepy. Standing in the center was a low, round table, which Ralph thought was the amputated top half of a barrel. The remains of a meal, some gray, rancid gruel that looked like liquefied brains congealing in a chipped soup tureen, stood on it. There was a single dirty folding chair. To the right of the table was a primitive commode, which consisted of a rusty steel drum with a toilet seat balanced on top of it. The smell rising from this was incredibly foul. The room's only decoration was a full-length brass-boarded mirror on one wall, its reflective surface so age-darkened that the Ralph and Lois captured within it looked as if they might have been floating in 10 or 12 feet of water. To the left of the mirror was a stark sleeping accommodation, which consisted of a filthy mattress and a burlap sack stuffed with straw or feathers. Both pillow and mattress glowed and raved with the night sweats of the creature who used them. "The dreams inside that burlap pillow would drive me insane," Ralph thought. Somewhere, God only knew how much farther under the earth, water was dripping hollowly. On the far side of the apartment was another, higher arch, through which they could see a jumbled, surreal storage area. Ralph actually blinked 2 or 3 times to try to make sure he was really seeing what he thought he was seeing. "This is the place, all right," he thought. "Whatever we came to find, it's here." Lois began to drift toward this second arch as if hypnotized. Her mouth was quivering with dismay, but her eyes were full of helpless curiosity. It was the expression, he was quite sure, that must have been on the face of Bluebeard's wife when she had used the key which unlocked the door to her husband's forbidden room. Ralph was suddenly sure that Atropos was lurking just inside that arch with his rusty scalpel poised. He hurried after Lois and stopped her just before she could step through. He grasped her upper arm, then put a finger to his lips and shook his head at her before she could speak. He hunkered down with the fingers of one hand tented on the packed dirt floor, looking like a sprinter awaiting the crack of the starter's gun. Then he launched himself through the arch, relishing the eager response of his body even at this moment, hitting on his shoulder and rolling. His feet struck a cardboard box and knocked it over, spilling out a jumble of stuff. Mismatched gloves and socks, a couple of old paperbacks, a pair of Bermuda shorts, a screwdriver with smears of maroon stuff, maybe paint, maybe blood, on its steel shaft. Ralph got to his knees, looking back toward Lois, who was standing in the doorway and staring at him with her hands clasped under her chin. There was no one on either side of the archway, and really no room for anyone. More boxes were stacked on either side. Ralph read the printing on them with a kind of bemused wonder. Jack Daniels, Gilby's, Smirnoff, J&B. Atropos, it seemed, was as fond of liquor cartons as anyone else who couldn't bear to throw anything away. Ralph, is it safe? The word was a joke, but he nodded his head and held out his hand. She hurried toward him, giving her slip another sharp upward yank as she came, and looking about herself in growing amazement. Standing on the other side of the arch, in Atropos's grim little apartment, this storage area had looked large. Now that they were actually in it, Ralph saw it went well beyond that. Rooms this big were usually called warehouses. Aisles wandered among great, tottery piles of junk. Only the stuff by the door had actually been boxed. The rest had been piled any which way, creating something which was two parts maze and three parts booby-trap. Ralph decided that even warehouse was too small a word. This was an underground suburb, and Atropos might be lurking anywhere within it. And if he was here, he was probably watching them. Lois didn't ask what they were looking at. He saw by her face that she already knew. When she did speak, it was in a dreamy tone that sent a chill scampering up Ralph's back. He must be so very old, Ralph. Yes, so very old. 20 yards into the room, which was lit with the same sunken, sourceless red glow as the stairway, Ralph could see a large spoked wheel lying atop a cane-backed chair, which was, in turn, standing on top of a splintery old clothes press. Looking at that wheel brought a deeper chill. It was as if the metaphor his mind had seized to help grasp the concept of Ka had become real. Then he noted the rusty iron strip which circled the wheel's outer circumference and realized it had probably come from one of those gay 90s bikes that looked like overgrown tricycles. It's a bicycle wheel, all right, and it's 100 years old if it's a day, he thought. That led him to wonder how many people, how many thousands or tens of thousands, had died in and around Derry since Atropos had somehow transported this wheel down here. And of those thousands, how many had been random deaths? And how far back does he go? How many hundreds of years? No way of telling, of course. Maybe all the way to the beginning, whenever or however that had been. And during that time, he had taken a little something from everyone he had fucked with. And here it all was. Here it all was. Ralph! He looked around and saw that Lois was holding out both hands. In one was a Panama hat with a crescent bitten from the brim. In the other was a black nylon pocket comb, the kind you could buy in any convenience store for $1.29. A ghostly glimmer of orange-yellow still clung to it, which didn't surprise Ralph much. Each time the comb's owner had used it, it must have picked up a little of that glow from both his aura and his balloon string, like dandruff. It also didn't surprise him that the comb should have been with McGovern's hat. The last time he'd seen those two things, they'd been together. He remembered Atropos' sarcastic grin as he swept the Panama from his head and pretended to use the comb on his own bald dome. And then he jumped up and clicked his heels together. Lois was pointing at an old rocking chair with a broken runner. The hat was right there, on the seat. The comb was underneath it. It's Mr. Wiser's, isn't it? Yes. She held it out to him immediately. You take it. I'm not as ditzy as Bill always thought, but sometimes I lose things. And if I lost this, I'd never forgive myself. He took the comb, started to put it into his back pocket, then thought how easily Atropos had plucked it from that same location. Easy as falling off a log it had been. He put it into his front pants pocket instead, then looked back at Lois, who was gazing at McGovern's bitten hat with the sad wonder of Hamlet looking at the skull of his old pal Yorick. When she looked up, Ralph saw tears in her eyes. He loved this hat. He thought he looked very dashing and debonair when he had it on. He didn't. He just looked like Bill, but he thought he looked good. And that's the important part. Wouldn't you say so, Ralph? Yes. She tossed the hat back into the seat of the old rocker and turned to examine a box of what looked like rummage sale clothes. As soon as her back was to him, Ralph squatted down, peering beneath the chair, hoping to see a splintered double gleam in the darkness. If Bill's hat and Joe's comb were both here, then maybe Lois's earrings. There was nothing beneath the rocker but dust and a pink knitted baby bootie. Should have known that it'd be too easy, Ralph thought, getting to his feet again. He suddenly felt exhausted. They had found Joe's comb with no trouble at all, and that was good, absolutely great. But Ralph was afraid it had also been a spectacular case of beginner's luck. They still had Lois's earrings to worry about, and doing whatever else it was they had been sent here to do, of course. And what was that? He didn't know. And if someone from upstairs was sending instructions, he wasn't receiving them. Lois, do you have any idea what... Shh! What is it? Lois, is it him? No. Be quiet, Ralph. Be quiet and listen. He listened. At first he heard nothing, and then the clenching sensation, the blink, came inside his head again. This time it was very slow, very cautious. He slipped upward a little farther, as lightly as a feather lifted in a draft of warm air. He became aware of a long, low, groaning sound, like an endlessly creaking door. There was something familiar about it, not in the sound itself, but in its associations. It was like a burglar alarm, or maybe a smoke detector. It's telling us where it is. It's calling us. Lois seized his hand with fingers that were as cold as ice. That's it, Ralph. That's what we're looking for. Do you hear it? Yes, of course he did. But whatever that sound was, it had nothing to do with Lois's earrings. And without Lois's earrings, he wasn't leaving this place. Come on, Ralph. Come on, we have to find it. He let her lead him deeper into the room. Atropos's souvenirs were piled at least 3 feet higher than their heads in most places. How a shrimp like him had managed this trick, Ralph didn't know. Levitation, maybe. But the result was that he quickly lost all sense of direction as they twisted, turned, and occasionally seemed to double back. All he knew for sure was that low groaning sound kept getting louder in his ears as they began to draw near its source. It became an insectile buzzing, which Ralph found increasingly unpleasant. He kept expecting to round a corner and find a giant locust staring at him, with dull brownish-black eyes as big as grapefruit. Although the separate auras of the objects which filled the storage vault had faded like the scent of flower petals pressed between the pages of a book, they were still there beneath Atropos's stench. And at this level of perception, with all their senses exquisitely awake and attuned, it was impossible not to sense those auras and be affected by them. These mute reminders of the random dead were both terrible and pathetic. The place was more than a museum or a pack rat's lair, Ralph realized. It was a profane church where Atropos took his own version of communion. Grief for bread, tears for wine. Their stumbling course through the narrow zigzag rows was a gruesome, almost shattering experience. Each not quite aimless turn presented 100 more objects Ralph wished he had never seen and would not have to remember. Each voiced its own small cry of pain and bewilderment. He did not have to wonder if Lois shared his feelings. She was sobbing steadily and quietly beside him. Here was a child's battered, flexible flyer sled with a knotted tow rope still draped over the steering bar. The boy to whom it had belonged had died of convulsions on a crisp January day in 1953. Here was a majorette's baton, with its shaft wrapped in purple and white spirals of crepe, the colors of Grant Academy. She had been raped and bludgeoned to death with a rock in the fall of 1967. Her killer, who had never been caught, had stuffed her body into a small cave where her bones, along with the bones of two other unlucky victims, still lay. Here was the cameo brooch of a woman who'd been struck by a falling brick while walking down Main Street to buy the new issue of Vogue. If she had left her home 30 seconds earlier or later, she would have been fine. Here was the buck knife of a man who had been killed in a hunting accident in 1937. Here was the compass of a Boy Scout who had fallen and broken his neck while hiking on Mount Katahdin. The sneaker of a little boy named Gage Creed, run down by a speeding tanker truck on Route 15 in Ludlow. Rings and magazines, keychains and umbrellas, hats and glasses, rattles and radios. They looked like different things, but Ralph thought they were really all the same thing. The faint, sorrowing voices of people who had found themselves written out of the script in the middle of the second act, while they were still learning their lines for the third. People who had been unceremoniously hauled off before their work was done, or their obligations fulfilled. People whose only crime had been to be born in the random, and to have caught the eye of the madman with the rusty scalpel. Lois, sobbing, "I hate him. I hate him so much." He knew what she meant. It was one thing to hear Clotho and Lachesis say that Atropos was also part of the big picture, that he might even serve some higher purpose himself, and quite another to see the faded Boston Bruins cap of a little boy who had fallen into an overgrown cellar hole and died in the dark, died in agony, died with no voice left after 6 hours spent screaming for his mother. Ralph reached out and briefly touched the cap. Its owner's name had been Billy Weatherby. His final thought had been of ice cream. Ralph's hand tightened over Lois's. "Ralph, what is it? I can hear you thinking, I'm sure I can, but it's like listening to someone whisper under his breath." "I was thinking that I want to bust that little bastard's chops for him, Lois. Maybe we could teach him what it's like to lie awake at night. What do you think?" Her grip on his hand tightened. She nodded.